The Moon and Sixpence, dramatized in four parts by Jeffrey Siegel from the novel by W. Somerset Maugham. With Ronald Pickup as Maugham himself, Patrick Allen as Charles Strickland, a character inspired by the real-life painter Paul Gauguin, and with Ronnie Stevens as Dirk Struve. Part 3, A Marriage Destroyed.
Appalled as I was by the news of disaster Dirk Struve had brought me, I could not suppress in myself a feeling of exasperation at his weakness. That his wife had been stolen from him, and that the man he had befriended and nursed back to health should have been the thief was bad enough. But that the Dutchman should have compounded their misdoing by leaving them in possession of his home, to me, verged on the contemptible. As regards the guilty pair themselves, I was not entirely surprised by Strickland's conduct. He had, after all, deserted his wife and children in England for what the respectable world would consider the flimsiest of reasons, and had never, in all my acquaintance with him, here in Paris at any rate, behaved in other than an utterly selfish and unfeeling manner. But Blanche Struve was another case altogether. I had always been alive, it is true, to the possibility that beneath her calm reserve there may well have lurked a whole world of passions that betrayed no hint of their existence. But I could not imagine that her husband had had no warning of what was to happen. I remembered that evening during the time when they were nursing Strickland through his fever, when I had sat with them all and seen that strange look in Blanche's eyes as she contemplated their involuntary guest. Now, looking back, its explanation could have been that she was growing dimly conscious of a feeling in her heart that surprised and alarmed her.
Listen, Dirk, if you hate my asking you questions, please say so.
No. It eases me to talk.
Then tell me, did you have no suspicion before today that there was anything between them?
Oh, yes, I've known it for, a fortnight at least. I knew it before she did.
Then why on earth didn't you send Strickland packing?
I couldn't believe it. It was incredible. She couldn't bear the sight of him.
Oh, that has certainly always been my impression.
I put this conviction of mine down to jealousy. I've always been jealous, but I trained myself never to show it. After all, I knew she didn't love me as I loved her. Well, that was only natural, wasn't it? But she allowed me to love her, and that made me happy.
So you made no move to get rid of Strickland?
No. In fact, I forced myself to go out for hours in order to leave them by themselves. You see, I wanted to punish myself for these suspicions, which were unworthy of me.
When I
came back, I found they didn't want me. Well, not Strickland. Oh, he didn't care if I was there or not. But Blanche, she shuddered when I went to kiss her, and then I was quite certain.
Still, you did finally tell him to go.
Oh, yes. I tell you, my dear friend, I was in agony. I didn't know what to do. And if I made a scene, I knew they'd only laugh at me. Well, I made up my mind to get him away quietly, without quarrelling. I chose my moment carefully and tried to make the request sound casual, but I couldn't stop the trembling of my voice. Oh, why didn't I hold my tongue? If I'd only waited, it could have gone all right. Oh, my poor Blanche. What have I driven her to?
What have you driven her to? She's the one at fault.
No, I am to blame.
You are certainly to blame for having walked out of your home and left them in possession.
Oh, come. You know as well as I do how Strickland lived. That filthy attic. I couldn't let her live in those circumstances. I simply couldn't.
She must have thought of that.
What would you have done?
What she's done? She's done with her eyes open. If she has to put up with certain inconveniences, it's her own lookout.
Yes, but you see, you don't love her.
Do you love her still?
more than ever. Strickland isn't the man to make a woman happy. It can't last. And I want her to know that I shall never fail her.
Does that mean that you're prepared to take her back?
I shan't hesitate. She'll want me more than ever. When she's alone and humiliated and broken, it would be dreadful if she'd know where to go.
But my dear fellow...
You see, it constantly happens that a man, when he's married, falls in love with somebody else. When he gets over it, he returns to his wife and she takes him back. And then if everyone thinks it's very natural, why should it be different with women?
I dare say that's logical, but most men are made differently and they can't see it that way.
Oh, then they are wrong.
What are you going to do now?
I shall wait till she sends for me.
Why don't you go away from
this? No. I must be at hand when she wants me.
Well, then, you'd better stay here.
Oh, No, I cannot impose on you, my dear fellow.
Where will you go?
Oh, hmm? I don't know.
You'll stay here.
Oh, no.
But for tonight, at least, you'll take my bed and I shall sleep on the divan in here.
Oh, no.
You
I
will
could.
Do as I tell you. And I shall give you a draught to make sure that you sleep.
Oh, my dear friend, you are so kind. So kind.
Exhaustion, plus the modest dose of Veronal I gave him, ensured that Struve was soon fast asleep. I, on the other hand, passed a wakeful night on my far from comfortable couch. But it was not the discomfort that kept sleep at bay. My thoughts were constantly occupied in trying to fathom the bizarre train of events that had brought Struve to my door. Even if it was merely the result of physical attraction, the implacability, the cruelty of Blanche Struve's decision to go to Strickland seemed quite uncharacteristic. It could be that she had never really cared for her husband, and that what I had taken for love, albeit amused and tolerant, had been no more than the feminine response to caresses and comfort which in the minds of most women passes for love. Perhaps also Struve's passion for her excited without satisfying a part of her nature, and she found in the close and continued presence of Strickland the power to give her what she needed. And for that reason, initially, she had feared and hated him, for I am sure she had been sincere when she so vehemently resisted her husband's plan to bring him to the studio.
Dick, I beg you not to let Strickland come here.
But he's ill. He could die.
I don't care. Anyone else, a thief, a drunkard, any outcast off the street, and I promise I'll do all I can for them gladly. But I beseech you, not Strickland.
Oh, but why, my precious, why?
I'm frightened of him. There's something in him that terrifies me. If you bring him here, it can only end badly.
That's unreasonable.
No, I know I'm right. He'll do us both some great harm. I know it. I feel it. Dirk, I implore you.
I wondered whether in her presage of disaster she already knew the form it would take. Even if not, the daily intimacy with the sick man must have affected her. She raised his head to give him food, and it was heavy against her hand. When she'd fed him, she wiped his sensual mouth and his red beard. She washed his limbs covered with their thick hair. And when she dried his hands, they were strong and sinewy. I recalled one of our quiet conversations as Strickland lay deeply asleep.
If you roll him towards you, I can change the sheet without waking him.
Are you sure?
Quite sure. Mm. When he sleeps like this, you could do anything. That's it. Now, put him on his back again. There.
That was very skillful. Where did you learn that?
At one time, I worked in a hospital.
Really? Did you ever have a patient like him?
I don't remember one.
Just didn't dislike him as much as you did.
More, if anything.
Of course, he's never thanked you for what you're doing for him.
Never.
He's inhuman.
He's abominable.
It was inevitable that she should love or hate him, and there is no doubt that at that time she hated him. Even now, perhaps, in the cruel grip of appetite though she was, she still hated him. But she hungered for him, and everything that had made up her life till then had now become of no account. All this was fanciful, speculation flitting through my mind as I tossed and turned. How could I know what were the thoughts and emotions behind that placid brow and those cool grey eyes? Still, whatever the explanations for Blanche Struve's behaviour might be, they were, at all events, plausible. Strickland's, on the other hand, I could not fathom at all. Oh, it was in no way strange that he so heartlessly betrayed his benefactor's confidence, nor that he gratified his whim without the slightest concern for another's misery. That was quite in character. It was the whim itself that I could not understand. I couldn't believe that Strickland had fallen in love with Blanche Struve. I did not believe him capable of love. He would have no time for tenderness, whether for others or for himself. He had admitted as much.
I tell you, life isn't long enough for love and art. And all that business, it's a disgusting waste of time.
Even so, human nature can be a nuisance sometimes, can't it?
I don't know what the hell you mean.
I mean that sometimes you cannot deny the overmastering desire to wallow in the mud at your feet. You find some woman, some low, coarse creature, and you fall on her like a wild animal. And when it's over, you're purified and can touch beauty as if it were a palpable thing.
Damn you. God damn you.
Though I fully believed that what I had presented to him was a true aspect of his nature, it was a quite inappropriate picture where Blanche Struve was concerned. She was no ghastly whore, and his conquest of her had no place at all in my analysis. She must have touched some chord in him of which I had no inkling. My brain must have accepted finally that it was utterly vain to attempt a true understanding of Charles Strickland, for at last I fell asleep. When I awoke, Struve had already left the apartment. A verbose note informed me that he had gone to the studio to collect his belongings, after which he would find a hotel, for he could no longer impose on my hospitality, which had been so kind and considerate, and so on and so on. It occurred to me that he probably hoped that they had not yet got his things together, and that he would have an opportunity of seeing his wife again and perhaps inducing her to come back to him. In the event, he found his traps waiting for him with the concierge, who told him that Blanche had gone out. Whereupon, knowing her routine and where she did her shopping, he went off to look for her. Suspecting that something like this might happen, I left the flat to look for him.
Blanche, my dear.
Oh, no.
Wait.
No.
Wait. You must let me speak to you.
Let me pass, please.
Yes, very well, but I shall walk along beside you. What I wanted to say, what I wanted to tell you, that I don't blame you for what has happened. In fact, it's probably my fault. Well, if it is, let me only assure you that I am abjectly sorry for it. In fact, if you will only tell me what it is I have done...
You have done nothing.
Then why? What is the reason? Sooner or later, you will come back to me, you know. Because Strickland will tire of you. It means nothing to him. Look, we'll go away somewhere. Somewhere where you can forget him and forgive me for having driven you to it.
Please leave me alone.
Oh, how can I? When I love you so much. When my heart is breaking because of you. Oh, have mercy, I beg you.
There. Now perhaps you'll stop pestering me.
Oh. Oh.
I saw what happened.
I can't believe it. She struck me.
I'm not surprised. Begging like that, humiliating yourself.
But I just can't let her go.
Well, that sort of behavior isn't likely to stop her.
What am I going to do?
I don't know. Suppose you go away. Why not go back home for a while to Holland? What's it called?
Oh, Althausen.
You've talked about it often enough. It seems a quiet, pleasant place.
No. No, I must be here when she needs me. It would be dreadful if something happened and I was not at hand.
What do you think is going to happen?
I don't know. But I'm afraid.
For all his pain, Dirk Struve remained a ridiculous object. He might have excited sympathy if he'd grown worn and thin, but he did nothing of the kind. He remained fat, and his round, red cheeks shone like ripe apples. It is hard when a man's exterior tallies so little with his soul. Dirk Struve had the passion of Romeo in the body of Sir Toby Belch, which made his suffering all the greater, and diluted the sympathy of his fellows.
Hey, Morn! Where the devil have you been all this time?
What do you mean?
I haven't seen you here for ages.
There are other cafes in Paris, you know. In fact, I was just on my way to one.
Lucky we spotted you passing.
Won't you join us, Mr. Morn?
Well...
Oh, come on, man. Otherwise, we might think you were avoiding us.
Now, why should I do that?
Well, you might have all sorts of reasons, but perhaps you've been away.
No, I've not been away.
Well, anyway, I'll sit down and take a drink with us.
Very well.
And perhaps we'll have a game of chess.
It's quite a while since we played.
Yes, I haven't thrashed you for ages.
Even longer ago than the last time I beat you.
Yes. Well, I admit you, you sometimes give as good as you get.
It's certainly pleasanter than when I let you win, and you're quite unbearable.
Well, I'll get the board. Oh, what's your drink, Absinthe? You know, this is the cafe where he first taught me how to drink the stuff.
Is that so?
I'm afraid his memory is slightly at fault.
Oh?
This is the cafe where we first drank absinthe together, but you had already learned the trick of it. Although, if you remember, you've not been in Paris long.
Oh, that's right. Yes, you came with a message from my wife, trying to get me to go back to England.
You'll remember that.
Ah, stupid woman. Well, is it absinthe?
No, just coffee, I think. Yeah.
Garçon, un café, l'échiquier, la pièce. Hein? Ah, well, here we are. Mm-hmm. The three of us. With one thing in common, at any rate.
Oh, what's that?
We're all three English.
True, but I shouldn't think the similarity goes much beyond that.
No.
I shall be going back to England. If not soon, at least in the foreseeable future.
Well, I shan't see the damn place again.
How about you, Mrs. Struve?
Who knows?
I've never asked you, but... how long is it since you were there?
Oh, a very long time. And I suppose I shall end my days out of England, too. I've no one there to go back to.
No family?
No. I'm an only child and my parents are dead.
And one's bones know nothing of where they lie. So who cares? There's a fine cemetery here in Montmartre. Right opposite a hospital, too. Here's that waiter.
He's coming. Oh, and the loser pays for the drinks.
The loser pays. This time.
I hear you've seen Blanche.
How on earth did you know that?
Someone saw you sitting with him. Huh. Why didn't you tell me?
I thought it would pain you.
Oh, what do I care if it does? You must know I want to hear the smallest thing about her.
Very well. What do you want to know?
What does she look like?
Well, she's quite unchanged.
Does she seem happy?
How can I tell? We were in a cafe. I played chess with Strickland. He was his usual boorish self.
But she... didn't she say anything? Didn't she give you any indication?
She spoke very little. She seemed pleased enough to see me, but then that could have been politeness.
Oh, I'm frightened. Hmm? I know something is going to happen. Something terrible, but I don't know what to do.
Calm yourself, my dear fellow.
I can't be calm, I tell you. I can't.
Well, you must.
I can't.
Now, listen to me. Now, will
I
you
can't.
Listen?
Yes. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, my dear friend, you are so kind. Yes, I'm listening. Yes.
Now, what has happened?
He's terrible for you. I don't deny that for a moment. I sympathize, and I will help you. You know that.
Yes, I know, yes.
Now, it's more than likely that before very long, she will find life with Strickland intolerable. Or he will soon tire of her, and there you will be, waiting, humbly, to forgive and forget.
Yes.
Mm. So while I have every sympathy for you, I can tell you I have precious little for her.
But there you see, you don't love her.
No. Well, there's nothing at the moment to prove she's unhappy. For all we know, they may have settled down into a most domestic couple.
Will you do something for me?
Willingly.
Will you write to Blanche for me?
Why can't you write yourself?
Oh, I've written over and over again. I didn't expect her to answer. I don't think she reads the letters.
You make no account of feminine curiosity. Do you really think she could resist?
Oh, she could mine.
You don't really believe that she'll come back to you?
I want her to know that if the worst came to the worst, she can count on me. That's what I want you to tell her.
Very well. What is it exactly that you want me to say?
I will tell you. Dear Mrs. Struve, Dirk wishes me to tell you that if at any time you want him, he will be grateful for the opportunity to be of service to you. His love of you is unaltered. You will always find him.
Though I was no less convinced than Struve that the affair would end disastrously, I did not expect the issue to take the tragic form it did. The summer came, breathless and sultry, and my thoughts were more often occupied with sunny beaches and the refreshing sea than matters of more immediate moment. Strickland I had seen nothing of for weeks, while Dirk, with his vain lamentations, had, I have to confess, begun to bore me, and I had avoided his society. I was still at my breakfast one morning, however, when he called on me.
My God, what's the matter with you? Come sit down. Will you have some...
She's killed herself.
What? Who? What do you mean?
She... Oh, God, I can't speak.
For God's sake, control yourself, man. What are you talking about?
I'm dying.
Here, now, drink this. It's water. Now, sit down and take a sip. It's all right, it's all right. I'm holding it for you, slowly, calmly. There. That's better.
Thank you.
Now, who's killed herself?
Blanche. They had a row last night. He went away.
And she's dead?
No, they've taken her to the hospital.
What are you talking about? Why do you say she's killed
please,
herself?
Oh, please, don't be angry with me. I can't tell you anything if you talk to me like that.
I'm sorry. No, take your time. Start at the beginning and tell me what's happened.
Vintercourtiers went up to the studio this morning. She could get no answer to her ring, but she heard someone groaning, so she went in. Mm-hmm. Blanche was lying on the bed. She'd been frightfully sick, and there was a bottle of color remover, oxalic acid, on the table.
Was she conscious?
Yes. Oh, my God. How she must be suffering. I can't bear it.
At all, you haven't got to bear it. She's the one who's got to bear it.
Oh, how can you be so cruel?
Yeah, go on. What happened?
The concierge sent for the doctor and then sent for me.
I see.
She also told the police.
So you were there... Well, how long after the concierge found her?
Oh, it couldn't have been very long, although the doctor was already there.
And she told you Strickland had left her?
No, she wouldn't speak to me. She told them to send me away. She tried to beat her head against the wall. Oh, it was terrible.
Oh, yes, all right.
She kept moaning, send him away, send him away. The doctor made me wait in the studio, and when the ambulance came and they put on the stretcher, he made me hide in the kitchen so she shouldn't see me as they took her out to the hospital. I followed them and arranged a private room for her. Please tell me, would you come back there with me?
I,
Perhaps she will talk to you. Oh, my dear friend, you've already been so much a part of this terrible affair, and someone must tell her what it is so important for her to know.
And what is that?
That my only desire is to help her, that I still love her, but I make no claim on her, and when she is well again, I will not try to induce her to return to me. She will be perfectly free. I want her to know all this, to set her mind at rest. Will you do that for me?
Of course I will. Just give me a moment to dress, and we'll go there right away.
C'était vous qui cherchez Madame Scroll?
Oh, yes, Doctor. Can we see her?
Oh, impossible. Out of the question.
Well, how is she?
As well as can be expected. She has swallowed a corrosive poison and is very sick.
Oh, my poor love.
Love? If one thought a little more carefully about what is done in the name of love, I, for one, should not be kept so busy.
That's as may be, Doctor, but Monsieur Struve has every justification for being concerned about his wife.
Ah, c'est votre femme.
Yes. Perhaps you would be so good as to tell her that I forgive her utterly, and I'm here when she wants me.
I shall tell her, as soon as I consider she's in a fit state to be told.
Is she out of danger?
Oh, on peut pas dire. One doesn't yet know how much she took. Women are constantly trying to commit suicide for love. But generally they take care not to succeed. It's usually a gesture to arouse pity or terror in their lover. Eh bien, vous devez m'excuser.
But when should I come and ask again?
Oh, this time tomorrow, perhaps. It might be possible for you to see her then. Good day, monsieur.
But, sister, yesterday the doctor said we would be able to see her.
She's a little better, but she still does not wish to see anyone.
You did tell her I was here, too, as well, with monsieur.
I did. She was very firm that she wished to see no one.
I see.
No one? Neither of us? But tell me, sister, is there anyone else that she has said she does want to see?
Monsieur, elle ne veut qu'on la laisse tranquille. She needs peace.
Well, forgive me, sister, but could I ask you to tell her from me that if there is someone else she wishes to see, I will bring him. Will you tell her that?
Oui, monsieur.
I only want her to be happy.
I will tell her.
Now?
When she is un peu plus calme.
No, now, please. It may cure her. Oh, I beseech you to tell her now.
Oh, very well, monsieur.
You know, my dear fellow, I think we really should...
No, wait, please. Hmm? She's asking her.
Her husband is here. He wants to know if he thinks there may be someone else you would like us to send
to. Oh, my God. What is happening?
I'm afraid, monsieur, that she will not see anyone. Elle ne veut voir personne. Absolument personne.
Can she not speak?
Oh, mais oui. I'm afraid her vocal cords were burnt by the acid.
Oh, no. No, I can't stand it.
Come. Let's go. We'll come back tomorrow.
Yes, you are right. Tomorrow it may be different.
Yes, look, you go on and wait for me. There's a good
fellow. Oh, yes. Very well.
Au revoir, monsieur.
Sister, has she told you why she did it?
No, monsieur. Pas un mot. She doesn't speak. She lies on her back quite quietly, but she cries always. Her pillow is constantly wet. She's too weak to use an handkerchief. And the tears just run down her face.
I see. Thank you.
I think at that moment I could have killed Strickland. I assumed he knew what had happened. Someone must have been to see him from the police, presumably back in the shabby attic from which we had rescued him. It was curious, though, that she didn't wish to see him. Perhaps she refused to have him sent for because she knew he would refuse to come. I wondered what an abyss of cruelty Blanche Struve must have looked into that's in horror. She refused to live.
That's why I don't understand it. Each day when I went, and I went twice each day, they said she seemed to be getting better.
If it was the same doctor we saw, he wasn't one to inspire confidence.
Well, sometimes it was him, sometimes it was the nursing sister. She was kind. Anyway, 2 days ago when I went, the doctor told me there were complications and that recovery was impossible.
I'm sorry.
Then I really knew despair.
Why didn't you come to me then?
Oh, I've done enough to involve you in my troubles. You've been so kind to me.
Nonsense.
Oh, everyone has been very kind.
Anyway, this was 2 days ago.
Yes, but yesterday when I went, the sister told me that, to her mind, Blanche had no will to live. I tried again to see her, but the sister persuaded me that I would only cause more harm.
She was probably right.
Oh, of course she was, kind soul. Blanche was by then speaking to no one at all, just lying quite still, willing her death. And then today, when I arrived, they said it was very near. They told me I might wait. Soon they came to say she was now unconscious and that I might go in. It was the first time I had seen her since...
Don't, my dear fellow. You don't need to speak of it if you don't want to.
Oh, but I do. You see, her mouth and chin were all burnt from the acid. It was awful to see her lovely skin all wounded. But by then she was near to peace at last. In fact, I didn't know she was dead until the sister told me.
He didn't weep for long. Sleep, the first normal sleep he'd had for more than a week, soon overtook him. I covered him up on the sofa where he lay and turned down the light. In the morning when I awoke, he was still asleep. He had not moved. His gold-rimmed spectacles were still on his nose. The circumstances of Blanche Struve's death necessitated all manner of dreadful formalities, but at last we were allowed to bury her. Dirk and I alone followed the hearse to the cemetery, that same Cimetière de Montmartre to which Strickland had jocularly referred at my last meeting with the two of them. We went at a foot pace, but once the interment was over, trotted back for all the world like any other Paris fiacre.
Don't you think that now it would be an idea for you to go away for a while?
I haven't thought about it.
No, of course not. But there can be no object in your staying in Paris now.
No.
You must try and gather the threads together again. Why don't you go back to Italy and start working?
Perhaps.
Anyway, well, now, you better come and have some lunch with me. I'll tell the driver to drop us at the Place Bigard.
I'd rather not. I want to go to the studio.
Ah. Would you like me to come with you?
No. No, thank you. I should prefer to be alone.
Right. Just as you wish.
It was his first visit to the studio since that wretched morning when he had been summoned by the concierge. What happened there on this occasion, I was to learn several days later when he called on me to make his farewells.
You are right, my dear friend. I am going away, but not to Italy, no.
Oh, where to, then?
I am going to Holland, back to Outhausen, where I was born.
That's wise.
I'm starting tomorrow. This is perhaps the last time we shall ever meet.
Oh, I hope not.
I haven't been home for more than 5 years. I think I'd almost forgotten it, but
But now I feel it's my only refuge.
Your parents are still living?
Yes, they're quite old now, but I know my mother still toils from morning till night, keeping the house trim and neat. You know, you won't find the smallest speck of dust anywhere in it.
Your father, I think you told me, was a carpenter.
That's right, and he wanted me to be a carpenter like himself and like his father before him. Perhaps if I had, I should have married a pretty flaxen-haired daughter of the saddle-maker who lived next door, and our son would have carried on the business after me.
Tragedy could have struck you there, too.
Yes, that is true. But the trials of life are easier to suffer when you are surrounded by the love of simple people. Their ignorance is better than all our knowledge. And there is a beauty in their quietness.
You chose to become a painter. How was that?
Oh, I had a knack for drawing. I got prizes for it at school, and then I won a scholarship to go to Amsterdam. Oh, my mother was so proud of me, though it nearly broke her heart to part from me. They pinched and saved so that I should have enough to live on, and when my first picture was exhibited, they came to Amsterdam to see it. My mother cried when she looked at it. And now on every wall of their house, there is one of my pictures in a beautiful gold frame.
Quite a contrast with the local surroundings.
Yes, I would like to think they bring the warm southern skies into that flat grey country. But if they do, it is all in a cheap, garish, simple fashion.
Oh, my dear fellow, you do yourself an injustice.
Oh, come, come. You know you don't believe that. You think what everyone else does about my paintings. I know what they call me. The master of the chocolate box.
Yes, but...
Yeah, and they're right. Yes. They are right. I should have followed my father's wishes and become a carpenter. Did you know I had been to see Strickland?
No.
Oh, well, you know already that I have no proper pride. After the funeral, you remember, you left me at the studio. I don't know what impelled me to go there then, perhaps. The vain hope that it was all a nightmare, that I would discover none of it had happened. In fact, as I dragged myself up the stairs, I was almost convinced that as I turned the key and opened the door, there she would be, my Blanche, bending slightly over the table, just like the woman in Chardin's Benedicite. You remember?
I remember. You always said she reminded you of Chardin. It used to embarrass her. But go on.
Well, there was no look of desertion about the place. Blanche, in her way, took just as great a delight in orderliness as my mother. Everything was in its appointed place. The bedroom looked as though she just left it. Her hairbrush and comb as a toilet table. Her nightdress in its little case on the pillow. It was impossible to believe she would never come into that room again. I had a vision of her in the kitchen alone, methodically washing the plates and glasses, the forks and spoons, then putting everything away, hanging the dishcloth up to dry, then having taken off her apron and rolled down her sleeves, picking up the bottle of oxalic acid and coming with it into the bedroom. I couldn't bear it. I call out her name. Blanche! Blanche!
You shouldn't have gone back there so soon.
Oh, yes. Yes, I should. You'll see. I went into the studio. Here, too, all was quite unchanged. Do you know exactly how my studio was?
I do.
Strickland appeared not to have disturbed things too much. There was only one canvas that seemed out of place. It was leaning against the wall. I realized it was one of his, and in a rage, I picked it up. I don't know, perhaps with the idea of hurling it out of the window.
But you didn't.
No. No, curiosity got the better of me. I set it up on the easel and stepped back. It was a nude. A woman lying on a sofa. A classic pose, but it was Blanche. At that moment, all my grief, my jealousy, and my rage, yes, above all my rage, burst out in a great scream of hatred. It was if Strickland, not Blanche, lay before me on the easel, and I looked round for something to strike with. All I could find was a scraper, which I lifted up like a dagger.
And?
I don't know. I had my arm raised, ready for some blow, when I suddenly seemed to see it.
See what?
The picture. It was a work of art. I couldn't touch it.
What did you see?
A great, a wonderful picture. It was as if Strickland had burst the bonds that had held him. You know, I've told you, I already saw the seeds of greatness in the man's work, but here they were at last in bloom. Oh, it was not only the bold simplification of the drawing, it was not only the passionate sensuality in the painting of the flesh, not only the solidity of it, so that you could almost feel the weight of the body, there was there something new. Something miraculous. He'd found not just himself, but a new soul with tremendous, unsuspected powers. Oh, I know this must sound like rhetoric. I know how I get carried away with my enthusiasm, but I do ask you to believe me, my dear friend, that here I was face to face with beauty. All its essence distilled in that reclining form. And it was not because it was the woman I had loved. It was in the soul of the man who painted it.
What did you say to Strickland when you saw him?
I asked him to come with me to Holland.
What?
We both loved Blanche. There would have been room for him in my mother's house. I think the company of poor, simple people would have done his soul a great good.
What did he say?
Oh, he smiled. Oh, he must have thought me very silly. He said he had other fish to fry.
Unfeeling swine.
He gave me the picture of Blanche.
I wonder why he did that.
Who knows? I didn't ask him. But I shall guard it forever. All I possess now is a box of clothes, some books, my own pictures, and that. That's all I take with me.
I'm glad you're going home.
It was, I felt, the only chance to put all the past behind him. His grief would be softened by the lapse of time, and a merciful forgetfulness would help him take up once more the burden of life. Always with him, though, the unconquerable buffoon, would be his love and understanding of beauty, which meant to him what God means to the believer. Sooner or later he would marry some honest soul in Holland, and I felt sure he would be happy. It amused me to think of the vast number of bad pictures he would paint before he died. The next day I saw him off for Amsterdam and was returning to my rooms when...
You're in a great hurry.
Oh, it's you.
I'll walk along with you.
Why?
For the pleasure of your society.
Why should you want that? I'm nearly home anyway.
I'll come and pay you a call.
You might wait for an invitation.
I would if I thought there was any chance of getting one.
I can't imagine why you want the society of someone who loathes and despises you.
My dear fellow, what the hell do you suppose I care what you think of me?
I suppose you're hard up.
I should be a damn fool if I thought I'd any chance of borrowing from you.
You have come down in the world if you can bring yourself to flatter.
You'll never really dislike me as long as I give you an opportunity to get off a good thing now and then.
Anyway. Come up and I'll offer you a pipe of tobacco. If you're going to make yourself at home, why not sit in an armchair?
Why are you concerned about my comfort?
I'm not, but it makes me uncomfortable to see someone sit on an uncomfortable chair. Struve told me that the picture you painted of his wife was the best thing you've ever done.
It was great fun to do.
Why did you give it to him?
I'd finished it. It wasn't any good to me.
Oh, I thought perhaps you might have felt you owed it to him.
No. So you know the little fat man came to see me?
Yes. And it's too much to hope, of course, that you were touched by what he had to say.
What about going to Holland with him? Yes, I thought it damn silly and sentimental.
I suppose it escaped your memory that you ruined his life.
He's a very bad painter.
And a very good man. You were dying. He took you into his home. He nursed you like a mother. He sacrificed his time, his comfort, and his money for you.
He enjoys doing things for other people. That's his life.
All right, you owed him no gratitude, but you didn't have to go out of your way to take his wife from him. Until you came on the scene, they were happy.
What makes you think they were happy?
It was evident.
Rubbish. She could never have forgiven him for what he did for her.
What do you mean?
Don't you know why he married her?
No, I don't.
Now, she was a governess in the family of some Roman prince, and the son of the house seduced her. She thought he was going to marry her. They turned her out, neck and crop. She was going to have a baby and tried to commit suicide. Struve found her and married her.
Just like him.
Yes. A woman can forgive a man for the harm he does her, but she could never forgive him for the sacrifices, all those sacrifices he made on her account.
What happened to the child?
That was stillborn 3 or 4 months after they were married.
Tell me something.
Hmm?
Tell me why you bothered about Blanche Struve. She couldn't bear the sight of you.
I know. I suppose it amused me. Oh, and damn it all, I wanted her.
Did you tell her?
There wasn't any need. She knew. At first she was horrified. And then she was frightened. And then I took her.
I see.
You talked to me once about myself, showed a certain amount of perception and understanding. I damned you for it. But it's true. Blanche Struve happened to be there.
But why did you want to take her away with you?
I didn't. When she said she was coming with me, I was nearly as surprised as Struve. I told her that when I'd had enough of her, she'd have to go. She said she'd risk that. She had a wonderful body, and I wanted to paint a nude. When I'd finished my picture, I took no more interest in her.
She loved you with all her heart.
I don't want love. I haven't time for it. It imprisons the spirit. All I wanted was her body.
What did you expect her to do when you left her?
Oh, go back to Struve. He was ready to take her.
Talking to you about feelings is as useless as describing colours to a man born blind.
Oh, that's very fine coming from you.
Huh?
Well, do you really care a tuppenny damn if Blanche Struve is alive or dead?
Of course I...
Oh, come on, be truthful. Does it make any difference to you? Does it matter to you?
Life had a great deal to offer her. I think it's terrible she should have been deprived of it in that cruel way. If I'm honest, I... suppose I must admit that it makes no difference. No, I don't really care. But I'm ashamed of that.
Then you haven't got the courage of your convictions. I tell you that most of life has no value. No value at all. Blanche Struve didn't commit suicide because I left her, but because she was a foolish and unbalanced woman. Oh, come, we've talked about her quite enough. Come, I'll show you my pictures.
So you can't disregard others entirely. Mm. Yes, it's impossible to live only for yourself and by yourself. Yes, sooner or later you'll be ill again, you'll grow tired and old, and then you'll crawl back to the herd.
Mm. Come and look at my pictures.
Haven't you ever thought of death?
Why should I? It doesn't matter.
Let's go and look at your pictures.
Now be careful. Some of the steps are uneven.
I know. Struve and I carried your dead weight all the way down, remember?
Oh, yes.
It would have been quite characteristic of you to forget.
Yeah. Well, here we are. Now, you better stand over there. I'll put the easel here and show them to you one by one.
You don't want me to say anything, I suppose?
No, blast you. Just hold your tongue and look. Now, here's the first one.
He showed me about 30 canvases. They were of different sizes. Still lifes, landscapes, about half a dozen portraits. And I wish I could say that I recognized at once their beauty and their great originality. In fact, I am astonished to recall that at first sight, I was bitterly disappointed. There were a number of features that struck me. First of all, the clumsiness of his technique. I thought he drew very badly. I knew nothing of the simplification at which he aimed. I just saw that in a still life, the plate was not round, and the oranges were lopsided. The portraits, on the other hand, were a little larger than life size, which gave them an ungainly look, almost like caricatures. And the landscapes puzzled me even more. They might have been painted by a drunken cab driver. Then the colours seemed to me extremely crude, and it passed through my mind that the whole thing was a stupendous, incomprehensible farce. Now I look back, I am more than ever impressed by Dirk Struve's acuteness. And indeed, puzzled and disconcerted as I was, I could not but feel that a very real and tremendous power was trying to express itself. Ugly as they were, these pictures suggested a secret of momentous significance. I fancy Strickland saw some spiritual meaning in material things that could only be suggested. In halting symbols. He saw a new pattern in the chaos of the universe and was attempting, however clumsily, to set it down.
That's the lot.
I wonder if you haven't mistaken your medium.
What the hell do you mean by that?
I think you're trying to say something. I don't know what it is, and I doubt if you do. But I'm not sure that the best way of saying it is by means of painting. But I do think I now know why you surrendered to your feeling for Blanche Struve.
Oh? Why?
I don't know what possesses you. These forms and colours are trying to tell me, but their meaning is only really clear to you. You're a pilgrim to some shrine. Some goal that may not even exist. But for a moment you thought you might find release in love. In a woman's arms. But you found no rest there. And you hated her for it. You'd no pity for her. Because you've no pity for yourself.
Really?
And you killed her. Out of fear. Because of the danger you barely escaped.
What a dreadful sentimentalist you are.
A week later, I heard by chance that Strickland had gone to Marseille. I never saw him again. But that is by no means the end of the story.
In part three of The Moon and Sixpence, dramatized in four parts by Geoffrey Siegel from the novel by W. Somerset Maugham, Maugham himself was played by Ronald Pickup, Charles Strickland by Patrick Allen. Dirk Struve, Ronnie Stevens. Blanche Struve, Rosalind Ayres. The Doctor, John Strickland. And the Sister, Helena Breck. The director was John Cardy.